The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Lisa Maxwell for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Good Old Days. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from a few editions of Good Old Days. Starting with the March-April issue, Good Old Days has celebrated America's 250th birthday with a series of articles that look back at how ingenuity, optimism, and spirit built a nation. And I'm going to begin with the first article, and it is from the March-April edition, and it is titled, The American Home, the Center of Our Lives. It all began with a single cabin, four walls of rough-hewn timber, a stone hearth, and a family's determination to carve out a life from the wilderness. Across the colonies, from the forests of Pennsylvania to the hills of Kentucky, early Americans built homes that reflected both their needs and their hopes. Shelter wasn't about comfort. It was about survival. Still even, there was pride in a sturdy roof and a swept hearth. A home represented freedom, the chance to claim land, raise a family, and live by one's own hands. As towns grew and prosperity followed, homes became a statement of progress. By the mid-1800s, Victorian-style homes rose in cities like Boston and Philadelphia. In New England, saltbox houses and Cape Cod cottages dotted the landscape. In cities like Charleston and Savannah, gracious homes featured wide verandas shaded by oaks. The front porch became America's favorite room. It was a place for cooling off on a summer night, waving to neighbors and watching children chase fireflies. The arrival of railroads spread lumber and brick far and wide, making decorative touches more accessible. Queen Anne houses, like San Francisco's Painted Ladies, reflected the ornate confidence of a growing nation. The Great Depression of the 1930s slowed construction, but not the dream. Americans learned to make do, repairing and reusing. Family farms and small towns became important parts of the landscape, yet new technologies continued to reshape the home. Sears, Roebuck & Company offered mail-order kit houses that, for under $1,500, arrived with every board and nail ready to assemble. Each house came with modern features such as indoor plumbing and electricity. For the first time, an ordinary family could afford a modern home. Entire neighborhoods sprang up from these catalogs, and thousands of these kit homes still stand today. After World War II, home ownership exploded. Returning soldiers used the GI Bill to buy houses in brand new developments. Uniform ranch homes symbolized stability and fresh beginnings. Driveways were filled with Chevrolets and Fords, and the backyard barbecue replaced the front porch as the heart of outdoor family life. Suburbia became the new symbol of arrival, a place where prosperity and privacy met. Even as decades passed, the shape of the American home continues to evolve. Split levels in the 1960s, open concept designs in the 1980s, and the fusion of farmhouse charm with modern technology that is seen today. From cabins to colonials, bungalows to brownstones, each generation has built upon the last, literally and figuratively, shaping not just the walls that shelter us, but the values that define us. Yet, at its heart, the dream hasn't changed. Home remains the heartbeat of the American story, where families gather, memories are made, and the promise of tomorrow begins. 250 years later, the light still glows in the window, a beacon of the enduring American spirit. And here's some interesting home costs through the decades for you. In the late 1700s, in early colonial times, a simple log cabin could be built for less than $50 if the homeowner built it himself. In rural towns, a modest home could be bought for $300 to $800, while a more upscale city house could be $1,000 to $2,500. In the early 1800s, craftsmen started plying their trade more, building homes for families that could go up to $3,000 to $4,000 for a substantial house in an urban area. In the late 1800s, although grand mansions existed at this time, most homeowners lived in modest structures of about $4,000 to $5,000. But after the Civil War, urbanization accelerated, with some bigger homes going upward of $10,000. In the early 1900s, in the 1920s, the average home price had increased to about $6,000 to $7,000. However, when the Great Depression hit, many lost their homes. In the mid-1900s, after World War II, housing boomed, with the average price for a new home increasing to $17,000 by the end of the 1950s. And by the 1970s, homes averaged from $27,000 in the early part of the decade to $74,000 by 1979. In the 1990s, that price jumped to $150,000 and continued to rise. And next, we're going to go to the May-June issue for the next article in the series, and it's titled Tools and Ingenuity. When America was born, its economy ran on muscle, sweat, and imagination. The early shopkeepers and blacksmiths who lined the dirt streets of colonial towns had no idea they were laying the foundation for one of the most dynamic business landscapes in the world. In 1776, a typical American business was humble but essential. A mill powered by water, a cobbler repairing boots, or a general store stocked with goods from the docks. But even then, invention was in the air. Benjamin Franklin, one of the nation's founders, was also one of its first great entrepreneurs, running a successful printing business in Philadelphia and inventing everything from bifocals to the lightning rod. By the mid-1800s, the country's business world was exploding with innovation. Steam power revolutionized manufacturing, while railroads connected small towns to big markets. In places like Pittsburgh, steel production fueled progress. In Chicago, meatpacking plants used assembly line thinking long before Ford made it famous. And in New York, immigrant-run garment factories turned a raw fabric into the fashions of a growing middle class. The early 20th century saw the rise of America's great industrial icons. Henry Ford's Model T rolled out of Detroit factories, John D. Rockefeller refined oil in Cleveland, and Andrew Carnegie Steel built the nation's bridges and skyscrapers. Even small-town businesses thrived, corner drugstores, diners, and service stations that became fixtures in daily life. By the 1950s, suburbia was booming. Companies like Whirlpool, Maytag, and General Electric filled homes with time-saving appliances. Franchises like McDonald's and Holiday Inn spread across the country, symbols of a new kind of American entrepreneurship, standardized convenience, and everywhere. Today's business world may look different, dominated by laptops and startups, but it's built on the same foundation of innovation and independence. From Etsy artisans to green tech engineers, Americans continue to do what they've always done best: see a need, dream up a solution, and make it real. And now I want to share with you some innovation through the ages. In 1793, the cotton gin. Eli Whitney's cotton gin transformed Southern agriculture. In 1837, the telegraph. Samuel Morse's telegraph shrank distances, allowing information to travel faster than ever before. 1869 brought us the Transcontinental Railroad. Rail lines linking the coast unified national markets and transformed the U.S. into an industrial power. In 1913, we have the assembly line. Henry Ford's assembly line didn't just change the auto industry, it revolutionized production everywhere. In 1927, commercial aviation. Scheduled airline service revolutionized travel. And in 1946, we got the electronic computer. ENIAC introduced digital computing, laying the groundwork for modern business automation. And in 1971, we have the microprocessor. Computers became smaller, faster, and affordable, igniting the personal technology revolution. And last, in 1991, we had the World Wide Web. Online connectivity reshaped commerce, marketing, media, and consumer behavior worldwide. The last article in the series is titled How We Heard the News, and it does come from the July-August edition of Good Old Days. And this one is titled How We Heard the News. In colonial times, news traveled at the pace of a horse. Newspapers like Benjamin Franklin's Pennsylvania Gazette and the Boston News Letter were printed weekly, their pages filled with essays, trade prices, and political debates. Pamphlets shared thoughts about the revolution, while town criers still shouted updates in city squares. By the mid-1800s, America was on the move, and so was its information. The manual wooden printing press of Franklin's time was replaced with an iron-based, steam-powered industrial machine that made printing very efficient. The New York Sun, launched in 1833, cost just a penny, making news accessible to ordinary citizens. Samuel Morse filed a patent for his prototype telegraph in 1837. In 1844, Morse sent his first message from Washington, D.C. to Baltimore. What hath God wrought? By 1861, telegraph lines that extended from the East Coast to the West Coast allowed reporters to send dispatches across the country, letting papers like the Chicago Tribune and the Boston Herald bring distant events home. As we entered the Civil War, illustrations from Harper's Weekly brought battle scenes to readers who had never seen battle. When the 20th century dawned, the nation began to hear the news, literally. In 1920, KDKA in Pittsburgh broadcast the results of the presidential election, marking the birth of commercial radio. Soon families were gathering in their living rooms to hear evening bulletins. Roosevelt's fireside chats in the 1930s reassured millions through the cackle or the crackle of static, while broadcasts from Edward R. Murrow in London during World War II brought the war's realities home. Television changed everything again. Introduced on NBC TV in 1948, by the 1950s, nightly newscasts became rituals in American households. Over time, anchors like John Cameron Swayze, Walter Cronkite, David Brinkley, and Barbara Walters became trusted voices. Viewers watched the civil rights movement unfold in black and white. When JFK was assassinated in 1963, the nation grieved together, glued to the screen. And just 6 years later, the nation watched Neil Armstrong step onto the moon live. By the 1980s, cable channels like CNN introduced the 24-hour news cycle covering the Challenger explosion and the Gulf War in real time. Then came the Internet, putting global news at everyone's fingertips. Local papers still existed, but the balance was shifting toward broadcast immediacy. By the mid-1990s, online sites like Yahoo News were delivering breaking stories directly to home computers. Soon, social media sites changed the way we took in our information and how we shared it. From the crackle of a radio to the glow of a phone screen, the media have changed, but the impulse is the same as it was in 1776, to connect, to understand, and to be part of the story. And here are some media moments over the years that I want to share with you. The first issue of National Geographic magazine was in 1888. This iconic magazine pioneered visual storytelling with powerful images that brought the world into people's homes. the War of the Worlds radio broadcast in 1938. This theatrical broadcast proved radio's power by convincing some listeners that a Martian invasion was real. End of World War II radio announcements in 1945. Millions of Americans learned from the radio that Germany and Japan had surrendered, and soldiers and sailors stationed around the world were coming home. 60 Minutes premiered in 1968. This long-running show invented modern investigative television journalism. TV broadcast of the first moon landing in 1969. History was made as families all over the world watched Neil Armstrong take one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. And last, CNN live coverage of the Challenger explosion in 1986. People were stunned as a national disaster played out live on TV. We're going to stay in the July and August edition of Good Old Days, and I'm going to share some stories with you about how families celebrated Independence Day, and the first one is titled, What America Means to Me. In the aftermath of the Dust Bowl, my newly widowed mother moved north in Montana to an Indian reservation to work feeding and housing men who were working for the Depression-era Civilian Conservation Corps, or CCC, bringing her seven children, ranging in ages from 11 months to 12 years. We had lost not only our father, but also our home, our farm, and everything that had made up our world. Mom, who was also in poor health, declared we were not going to be a burden to society. We're not going to live on the dole, as she put it. We would all get jobs and we would survive. This was America. Mom acquired a house on the north side of town, high on the bank above the Poplar River. That river proved to be both a bank and a blessing. The river was a playground for the Indian children, and we'd lose about one a year to the river. They'd jump off the car bridge upstream onto an ice cake, ride it downstream to the swinging bridge, and then try to grab onto the cable under the bridge to hoist themselves up off the ice cake. If they missed, they went on around the bend to the railroad bridge a mile away. If you missed there, you were a goner, for after that the Poplar River flowed into the mighty Missouri. My younger brothers, Billy and Pete, eventually thought the river was the ideal place to play also. Mom would whip them and make them promise not to go back down to the river, but they did go back at every chance, brushing the telltale sand out of their clothes and hair in hopes Mom would be too busy to notice. Finally, my little brothers came up with a plan. Because food money was tight and meat had to come by, and meat hard to come by, maybe Mom would allow them to go down to the river if they only fished. She did, and they did, bringing home shiners, bullheads, catfish, and other fish, which Mom fried up to the boarders' delight. Of course, the boys always wore their swimming trunks under their pants. My oldest brother, Marion, worked on a farm several miles northeast of town across the river. He was probably 14 by then. Little Billy saw him as a father figure and would walk to meet him if Marion was allowed to walk home on a weekend. Come the 4th of July, Billy headed upriver following the bank under the towering cottonwoods, happily anticipating their swim together. On nearing the swimming hole, he heard music. He crept closer and saw a picnic underway. A metal box hung from a low branch, and from it flowed the most beautiful voice. It was America's beloved Kate Smith singing God Bless America. Billy loved her, too, for Kate Smith was a motherly figure with a voice as rich as Fort Knox. She was asking God's blessing on our beloved country. Billy, his heart swelling, burst into tears. How blessed we were to live in America and have Kate Smith to sing about it. Mom admonished us to work hard and make something of ourselves. Billy and Marion became machinists. Billy worked for a Columbia Iron Works, and Marion worked for Crown Zellerbach on the West Coast. Another brother, Marvin, became a rancher and county commissioner in North Dakota, and Pete became a petroleum engineer. We three girls became school teachers and eventually married farmers. Mom taught school most of her life and lived well past 104. All four boys served in the military. America, land that we love, truly was the land of opportunity for our family. And this story was submitted by Maxine Melton. And next, June Zarneski submits an article titled, A Patriotic School Play Debacle. In the back end of what? I asked as Mrs. Judson, the stage director, checked a list on her clipboard. I'm sorry, the horse is the only part left if you and Renee want to be in the play. I groaned and nodded. Renee hurled a smug smile. Mrs. Judson was suggesting that we wear the two-person costume of Paul Revere's horse. At least Renee would get to be the front end of the horse. I would be the back end. How did I get myself into this mess? As America's semi-quincentennial approaches, my mind wanders back to 1976. I was in seventh grade at Burdick Elementary School in Milwaukee. It was the year of the U.S. Bicentennial celebrating 200 years of independence for America. The anticipation and media frenzy was tremendous. Schools, businesses, and church groups across the country were preparing for the holiday in even bigger and more spectacular ways. There were numerous television shows highlighting the event. One network aired a daily bicentennial minute showcasing important events in America's War of Independence. Burdick was no exception to the hype. Like so many other teachers, Mrs. Judson, our history teacher, was preparing a special bicentennial play. It was to be performed on our school stage sometime during the last week of school before summer vacation. Mrs. Judson selected a series of vignettes celebrating important American events. One vignette would show Betsy Ross sewing the flag, another would show George Washington crossing the Delaware, and yet another would feature the midnight ride of Paul Revere. A flurry of students volunteered to create the sets and sew the costumes. I didn't want a behind-the-scenes role. I eagerly aspired to the prima Betsy Ross part. Of course, Renee Vernon, names have been changed to protect the innocent, was coveting the same role. I should have known my nemesis would want the same thing. Without ever saying it aloud, we competed with each other constantly, whether it was in the spelling bee, vying for safety cadet, or trying out for chorus. I always felt slightly intimidated by her. Being an only child, Renee had the nicest clothes of any seventh grader in the school. She often paraded her luxurious threads in front of class, especially the silky, snow-white pantsuit she wore on occasion. She strode up to the chalkboard during class with an obvious sway and Cheshire cat smile as she looked down upon her frumpy classmates. Alas, as it turned out, neither of us was chosen to portray Betsy Ross. When the dusty horse costume was pulled out of storage, Renee and I stared and sniffed it. It was dark brown with matted faux fur that had seen better days. There was a front end and a back end with an overlapping middle. There was no zipper. The head itself was made of papier-mâché with flecks of paint missing from the snout and ears. "Give me that head," Renee demanded, relegating me to the less flattering equine rear end. When we tried on the costume, I heard snickering classmates. I was mortified. It was hot inside, and I immediately felt sweaty. I also didn't appreciate the view of Renee's backside as I hunched over into my role. But things got worse. Mrs. Judson opened the seam that separated us and said, "Here's the board." The board? Yes, not only would we be the horse, but we would actually have Paul Revere sitting on top of us on that board. As Mrs. Judson was well aware, this would be quite the acrobatic feat for us to balance a board above us and carry someone. So, thinking ahead, she had chosen Tim Jasper, who had the diminutive stature of a jockey, to play Paul Revere. As the days grew closer to the performance, Renee and I actually balanced the board fairly well with Tim perched on top. "This thing smells like mothballs," Tim complained. "How would you like to trade places with me?" I retorted sarcastically. The night of the performance finally arrived. We grew jittery watching parents and friends filter into the auditorium. Parents took pride in their offspring's respective roles. Some brought flowers to present to their little darlings after the performance. Renee's parents carried in a huge bouquet of red roses. "Maybe your parents should have brought you oats," I said to her wryly. "Shut up, backside," she bellowed. Flashes from cameras were everywhere. I was glad I was hidden from view. I assumed the proliferation of cameras was the reason Renee had donned her beautiful silky white pantsuit instead of something practical like jeans and a sweatshirt. Finally, on cue arrived, "Hear ye, hear ye," Tim shouted. I could hear him through the costume, along with the bell he was ringing. Balancing the board between us, we strolled across the stage, but something happened. The board shifted. I felt Tim pitch to the left. The audience heaved a muffled hush. Renee maintained standing as Tim and I hit the floor. The audience roared with laughter for what seemed an eternity. I will never forget Renee standing in half of the horse costume, her head sticking out where the horse head should have been, her prim white pantsuit smudged and dirty. After that humiliating day on stage, Renee's bravado diminished. Playing the back end of a horse was one of the most embarrassing moments of my life, but I took great satisfaction in knowing Renee Vernon would always be remembered as Burdick's bicentennial horse. I'll end today's story with a quote from Henry James. Summer afternoon to me, those have always been the two most beautiful words in the English language. We have run out of time for today's episode of Good Old Days. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time, and I'm Lisa Maxwell, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Good Old Days is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-513. That number again is 919-832-5138. I'm sorry if I've gotten that number messed up. And I thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.